Hey, well, welcome back to the Modern Mindfulness Podcast. I'm your guide here, Rebecca, and today I have Dewey Freeman. Hi, Dewey.
Hi, I'm so happy to be here. I'm excited. So thank you for having me.
Oh my gosh. Yes, you're so welcome. And me too. And yes, we'll get riding that excitement in just a moment here.
Perfect.
I'm going to share just a little bit about you first. You're a man of so many layers of wisdom, and I'm not sure if this bio will encapsulate all of that, but we'll give it a shot here. Dewey is a sought-after teacher, trainer, licensed psychotherapist, university professor, and horse professional around the world. He has traveled to teach professionally in over 8 countries, has developed a practical attachment theory and human development model that is taught to thousands of university students and clients, has over 75,000 direct client hours, and co-founded both the Gestalt Equine Institute and the Gestalt Institute of the Rockies. He provides supervision to therapists and graduate students, does business and land consultations for new equine therapy sites, and models being a lifelong student to your passions. Gestalt and relational horsemanship are not just approaches to Dewey. They are how he walks through the world. He embodies both tenderness and strength in all his relations and work. His quality of contact and relationship with others is authentic and unique, and has many people coming from around the country and world to study with him. He has worked incredibly hard to master his arts and finds great joy in teaching honest students. Dewey is a true elder and mentor and is exploring new horizons in facilitating men's growth work through retreats and psychoeducation groups. There's plenty more to read about you, but for now, Dewey, officially welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. That guy that you just read about sounds really cool.
He does, like, doesn't he? Yeah.
Who is that?
It's always interesting to hear bios, isn't it? It's like,
yeah, it
is that me? Yeah. Did I miss anything in that? Is there any more to share?
Nothing big. Yeah. I'm sure that stuff will come out as we chat. And
yeah.
And if you have any questions or around anything, I'm open. So yeah. Feel free to ask those pieces, or I may include a couple other things.
Beautiful. So. Yeah. Thank you. Will do. And as we were chatting before we hit record, you know, we're recently acquainted here for the first time. And so just like getting to know each other. And as you were so generous in asking, you know, what does the show need? What can you bring? Because there are so many things you could share. Mm-hmm. And we agreed that your work with attachment would be a good place to start. I think for our listeners, and even just for me personally, and also professionally, what I hear come through in conversations with clients and whatnot. And attachment, the word is out there a lot in all the ways. I think people are discovering that there are attachment styles and theories. Could we start almost like ground zero here? Like, what is attachment? Like, where do we even begin?
Where does it come from? And
and
maybe even how did I get into it?
Yeah, those would all be great.
Yeah, let me just share. I mean, it's interesting. Yes, is there any more to add? And I'll add this piece. In 1949, when my mother was pregnant with me, about 5 months into her pregnancy, she was diagnosed with tuberculosis. And in 1949, tuberculosis was basically a death sentence to people. A few months later, when I was born, she was whisked away. I was born and I was whisked away from her, and she was whisked away and taken to the sanitarium, where she spent the next close to 18 months. And I did not connect with her, and I was not held by her or around her until I was 18 months old. And when I moved back in, there's actually a newspaper article that basically says that I was like a neighbor kid moving in. So I didn't know it then, or most of my childhood, or my even early adulthood, that how deeply that affected me. But as I began being in my early 20s, I'm just messing one relationship up after another, after another, after another, and carrying actually at the time an incredible amount of rage that I would be like Mr. Nice Guy, and then it would be like, where did all that come from? All that rage or all that hurt? I started looking at what was going on with me and what was happening. And what was interesting was, and some of this came actually through my schooling. I was getting my master's degrees when I was in my early 20s, early to mid 20s, and working with a guy named Foster Klein, who was an early attachment therapist and theorist. And it was like, oh, I'm working with kids who have major attachment issues, and those kids are me. At the same time, it's like, so I'm working with a 12 or 13-year-old boy, for instance, and it's like, I know that kid. I know what was going on with that kid and inside, from the inside out. And so I began a journey of looking at what's attachment, what went on for me, and ultimately then what do I need to do, or what do I need to do, if I'm talking from that place, to actually be okay in the world and be have some level of attachment, to where I'm not just blowing up relationships, even though I don't want to be blowing up relationships, but I am. In that work, I began the process of putting together attachment theory. So if you could imagine early on, that was in the late 70s and early 80s, the idea of attachment and attachment theory, it was in its infancy. And when Bowlby was and Mary Ainsworth were doing their things, I was incredibly fascinated by them. What that led to was me trying to figure out what needed to happen for me, but also what needed to happen for those people I was working with, because my master's degree, which was like a double master's in special education and counseling. And so it was like, okay, what is this and what do I need to do with this? So that's where I began putting some stuff together. And interestingly enough, I started working with people most, and I had graduated and I was a therapist in a school. I became a principal of that school for a few years. And then I did more training in Gestalt therapy and went out on my own. And most of the people I was working with at the time were actually people who had been adopted. So their stories and my stories were fairly similar. Because it was almost like my mother adopted me and I didn't know her. And before I go on, I actually want to say a piece here about my mother, who thankfully she lived to 83. And, so this always touches me, even though our early lives were together. My early life with her was very disrupted. She worked very hard to do the very best she could to repair. So I just want to give her that credit. And came up with a piece of what really needs to happen in an attachment process. And there are a lot of theories out there that speak about attachment, but they don't look at attachment in the way of what process do we have to go through to reestablish attachment if we don't have it. And how can we do that in a pretty straightforward and simple way? So that's what I, over the years, began putting together. And it was probably around the early 90s to mid 90s that I actually started figuring that out. So so if you're open to it, I can go into that a little bit.
Yeah.
I also want to throw in a piece here. If this is okay with you, you and I were talking a little offline about attachment the way I'm talking about it right now. And then sort of the idea of as we grow, that we can move into a non-attached place. To me, those are two very different things. One of those things that I'm talking about is the process of what we need to do, and that process begins in utero and goes when things go in a good way, when things are healthy, it goes about the first 2 to 3 years of life. So we're talking basically the first, if we begin at conception until 3-ish, basically about a 4-year process when things go really well. And that's a different process than what I'm talking about, what I would talk about if I'm talking about sort of a non-attached perspective in life. The non-attached perspective in life, to me, has a lot to do with non-judgment. Like, can we go through our lives and not judge the outcome of what we're trying to do, or not judge relationships, or not judge ourselves, or not judge others, which is a different kind of a, I think it's very needed, but it's a different kind of process that I'm talking about right now. Does that make sense? Before I
jump
into anything else?
Yeah. And with attachment, thank you for that full share and explanation. And I think too, we'll loop back to the non-attachment, because I think it is important to share that, especially with the spiritual things that I aim to share. And there's definitely a place for all of this. And so you mentioned your birth story, essentially. Mm-hmm. And so for the listeners out there, I do encourage people, if they can, learn more about their birth story, the first couple years of their life. I think it can inform a lot. And I have met people where, whether they've been adopted or they don't know, or mom doesn't remember all the key pieces. So is there value just in knowing the birth story, or can people almost like reverse engineer understanding who they are today? Like, are there, you mentioned the rage that was showing up for you. Are there some other like telltale signs that there's something to learn to go into from those first couple years? Or
The biggest thing. So let me take for a moment, and I'm more than happy to go into more detail around some of the attachment stuff. But for the biggest thing, the one biggest piece, from if people look into virtually any attachment theory in the world, doesn't matter. There's many ways that people come in. Some people come in through genetics. Mm-hmm. Some people come in through relationship. Some people, there's been tons of research around nervous system processes, tons of research around relational processes. But the biggest key thing in every relationship, whether it's a relationship in utero, then through birth, and then through early life, or whether it's relationship when you first meet somebody and say get into, like, for instance, a romantic relationship or an intimate relationship with a partner, the biggest thing that we have to be able to do to deepen relationship, to deepen intimacy, and to deepen attachment is to learn how to go through a tough time in contact, in relationship with another person, and come out okay. That's what we have to learn how to do. And I'll give an example of that, like in infancy, for instance, or even the birth process itself. So you asked if people can, like, what are some of the sort of telltale signs? The biggest telltale sign is for people, one, not being able to stay in contact in relationship. And I can talk about what contact means to me. And also not being able to stay in contact and go through a rough time with someone else in contact in relationship and come out okay. So people go in, say they get into conflict with their partner and they leave. Or they get in a conflict with a friend and they blow up. Or they get in a you're going down the road and somebody cuts you off and, you know, you flip them off and tell them to go fuck themselves. Those kind of things. It's like there's sort of a movement, or there's been a lot of process. I don't know if that's the right word. A lot of teachings, actually, or learnings, or more societal things right now that don't teach us how to go through a tough time in relationship, in contact with ourselves and with another, and come out okay. We don't know. Most people don't know how to do that.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yes. And I think that's, I like to use the way you do something is the way you do anything. And
yeah,
we can get to the relational part, and it is like, everything is relationship. And it's like you said, for the listeners, it's like, even how do you deal with someone who cuts you off on the highway? How do you have the conversation of, you know, if there's an argument at home, how do you interact with your friend when there's some, you know, friction? And it's all relationship. And so if there's a little glimmer of something here, you know, there's, it's probably echoing in other places. And so to let those be little signs, I don't want to call them red flags, but just little symbols that there could be some attachment work to explore. Well,
if they keep happening, and those processes happen where we don't stick with something, then they do become red flags.
Yeah.
Or if we get really angry and shut things off, or if we shut down, those do become red flags.
Yeah.
So let me walk through just briefly. Now, when I teach this, actually, Kimberly, my partner, and I just taught a 2-day class on Reiki and body structures and breath work and attachment development models. We integrated those two. In utero, so this is going to be quick and dirty. And actually, if you want, after this, after we get offline, I can actually send you a diagram of this.
Oh,
if,
cool.
If that would be that would be helpful to you and to people listening. In utero, we always get food, touch, and movement from our moms. And the first thing I want to do is walk through a healthy process. So we get food, touch, and movement. You know, we're always being fed through the umbilical cord. We're always being touched by the inside of the uterine wall in our mother's wombs. And we're always being moved through her breath or walking. Like, there's never a time that we're not being moved. Later in life, those three things turn into wanting nurturing. So food is nurturing, and it remains food too. Touch is contact, sort of a continuum, and it remains touch also, but contact is like eye contact and emotional contact, spiritual contact. And movement turns into what I label emotion, which is like an E with a dash in motion. So when energy moves through our bodies, the way that we define energy moving through our bodies is we call that emotion. So, and you can watch it in people, energy can come up. If someone's angry, energy can go down, those kind of things. So those are the three things that we always get in utero. When we're born, we want those three things still. And a baby asks for those three things by crying, by slobbering, by pooping their pants, by wiggling around, and their biggest thing they do is they're just so cute. And they ask for those things by that. And we go, oh my gosh, you need, when we see that as a parent or caregiver, we hopefully pick up our child. We rock them. We change their diapers. We feed them. We make contact with them. And we do all of that in sort of a energetic field of love, hopefully. When that happens, our babies go, they settle, and it's sort of a loop or a cycle or a circle. They settle and they come out and they go, they just went through a hard time and they came out okay. And then when that happens repeatedly and they go through that cycle, they begin to create trust. And then when that happens and that's predictable over time, that's actually what creates attachment.
Mm. Yes.
Same thing. When two people go out on a date for the first time, what do? They go have dinner and maybe they take a walk, maybe they hold hands and they go down by the river and they're walking or whatever. I mean, we do the exact same thing. Mm-hmm. In a study, I did a study in the early 90s, babies do that whole cycle between 10 and 15 times an hour when they're awake. Wow. And that whole cycle can be as short as a baby, maybe in a crib, and they go, and you reach over and you rock them and touch them, and they go, that's a whole cycle. The sometimes that cycle is longer when, say, a baby's upset or maybe sick or they have colic or their teeth are coming in. Sometimes that cycle isn't hours long because they're teething and their teeth hurt and those kind of things. So that's quick and dirty, that what I call the attachment cycle. But two things can happen in that thing can sort of go awry. More than two, but I'll talk about sort of the two biggies. If that cycle gets interrupted by us meeting baby's needs, but we're not in contact, then what happens is that the baby actually attaches to the food, touch, and movement instead of attaching to the caregiver that's giving them. And that's actually where addictions come from, is that food, touch, and movement become their primary attachment objects instead of the person providing the food, touch, and movement. Mm-hmm. That makes sense?
Yeah, and that's powerful. Yeah.
Yeah, it's sort of a big deal.
Yeah.
It's simple, and it's one of the most complex things that you can deal with in therapy or in growth or in work. The other piece that happens is if that food, touch, and movement, if that gets cut off, and just imagine like a three-month-old laying in a crib and nobody attends to that, to him or her, is they only have two options. They can either rage or they shut down, or they rage or they shut down. Mm-hmm. When sometimes babies go back and forth, and sometimes they pick one or the other. And because a baby can't, you know, get up, jump out of their crib, tootle over the refrigerator, warm up a little milk, and go back and feed themselves. That's actually why, that's where my rage came from, is because of the, now my mother didn't abandon me, but that's what I felt.
Right.
And of the craziness and chaos around that, because that was a big deal. And so I actually have a memory at 4 months old, laying on a dirt floor. This was in the Amish community. That's where I grew up, with a fireplace. And I was on a nice little pad. I wasn't being neglected, but I made a decision. I'd never depend on anybody because it hurt too bad to be in contact. And, you know, I was experiencing a huge loss because our mothers, when we're in utero for essentially 9 months, that's the only person we really know. We can hear fathers and other people on the outside, but our main attachment person is our mothers. So that piece of working, if people have experienced early on some of those attachment interruptions, which most of them are actually caused by, most people think, let me rephrase this, most people think that attachment issues are caused by neglect, and that's actually not true. Some are caused by neglect, some are caused by abuse. But most of the attachment issues that people deal with are not from that. Like mothers are stressed, or parents are poor and they don't know where the rest of their food's coming from, or there's postpartum depression, or somebody gets sick, or people are overwhelmed. I mean, those kind of things. Those are the kinds of things that cause most of the early attachment issues. Mm-hmm. And so what we do, if we can't go through those processes of being able to go through a hard time and come out okay, which our first big one is birth. So it's like, that's a big deal. And for you and all of your listeners, just, you know, my question is, look, see if you can find out your birth story. I mean, there's story after story after story of people being breached and not coming out, and then having to go through all kinds of stuff, or being stuck in the birth canal, or, I mean, there's just story, or, you know, the birthing process took, you know, 38 hours. And I mean, those kind of things. And so the biggest piece that's happening here is life, which is sort of it's not our parents or our mothers being horrible, bad people. It's that just tough things happen and we don't know how to get through it. So that's where we begin learning to go through really hard times and come out okay. And the three primary things we need in relationship are food nurturing, touch slash contact, and movement plus emotion. So let me just put that out there, and I don't know what thoughts or questions you have. And
yeah, thank you for that. The quick and dirty, and we'll get the diagram you mentioned, and I'd love to link that for everyone to see too. And the phrase that comes to mind is knowledge is power. And when people can learn their birth story, whether it directs them towards understanding, I think perception or perspective. Yes. So I want to talk a little bit about repairing and healing. And I think for some, it might even be enough. This is just me guessing here, but to ask mom or ask caregiver, what was it like? If you have no idea what it was like in that first chunk of your life, and even you might be thinking one thing, like you said, as a baby, all you're really concerned with is getting fed, getting the things.
You're just trying to stay alive.
You're just trying to stay alive. And mom also is probably trying to keep you alive, but your perspective might have been abandonment. When you can just learn and hear from your caregiver, well, this is actually what life was like, then even just understanding, I'm sensing, could help mend that already. Is that true? And are there other ways, if people are listening, you know, how do we start to heal if they're, this is like, I love these conversations, and really partly why I love having the podcast of, I'm hoping that this can be this conversation right here. Listeners are hearing this. Maybe it's a little crack where the light can come in type of thing. And so now, if just one person out there is getting curious around their birth story, around, wow, yeah, this feels familiar to me. How do I now, I'm going to say it's never too late to heal. So can you share a little bit more, like, is understanding the birth story enough to start a healing process? Are there other common ways, or is there another quick and dirty around how do you start to step into healing this attachment piece for people if they're sensing there's something?
Absolutely. No, there's two pieces. So this is another part of the story. On my birthday, my 34th birthday, my mother, I grew up in Ohio, but I moved to Colorado in 1970. On my 34th birthday, my mother was out visiting me. And I remember exactly where we were and the conversation we were having. And I was talking about the therapy I was in. I was talking about the work I was doing. I was talking about how I struggled in relationships. And in the middle of that conversation, it dawned on me. I felt like I got hit by a lightning bolt of nobody had ever asked my mom what it was like for her. Mm. Nobody.
Gave me chills. Yeah.
Yeah. And they did. And she stared at me for about 3 minutes. She was so stunned. It was like, oh, somebody actually asked me this. And she dropped into, she just stared at me. Then she started sobbing and sobbing and sobbing. And that's actually what shifted our relationship. And it wasn't that she apologized. It wasn't that, because she felt as guilty as could be. I mean, she was smoking. That's part of what gave her tuberculosis and opened her up to that. Back then, no one thought smoking killed people. Well, people knew, they just wouldn't tell anyone. But it was like, it's that level, that relational level of going, Mom, what was that like for you? And that literally shifted everything. And one of the pieces, and it shifted all of the stuff around, because what happened was she was going through a hard time, and we came out of that okay. And instead of it just being one way toward me, and I think it was probably, I would say that was the day I became an adult. Instead of, you know, living in that much younger place developmentally. And the, so the first place to go, you're right, is to become sort of a sleuth, become your own self-detective. You know, it's like, what happened and how did it happen and what was going on and what were the circumstances and how, you know, what was the mindset of people? How scared were people? How happy were people, all of those kinds of things. And part of what we know now with all of the work with polyvagal theory and all of the genetic and epigenetic studies that we're doing, all of those kinds of things, we are literally beginning to go, oh yeah, this is all making sense. And even you mentioned that you had been studying some somatic experiencing stuff. A lot of somatic experiencing is about helping people go through a hard time and come out okay. That's a lot of what it is.
Yeah.
And doing that in a really kind, gentle way. And it's like, so in some ways, we do need to go find out exactly what happened to the best of our ability. And then, but going through in relationship with another person, the process of coming out, of going through a hard time and coming out okay, helps heal. Even if we're going through it in the present and can be fully present, and it actually helps heal this earlier stuff. So let me talk about two incidences real quick where it was really important to know what happened early on. Working with a man who now is in his early 50s, 52, 53. At 50 years old, he found out, and we were working together then, and I asked him to do a bunch of exploration. He actually found out the man who he thought was his biological father was not. And his mother had been she was having sex with two different men. Nobody was married at the time. And she just picked one man and said, oh, this is your father. Well, it turned out to be not. And so his entire life he had been searching because his mother was holding this secret. And at some point he did ask his mom, and his mom said, yeah, she knew. But she was holding the secret. So it was like he could not fully attach to her, because when we hold secrets, we can't do that. I mean, it's just been... I mean, you said you have a partner. I mean, I have a partner. If we hold secrets from each other, it lessens the attachment. It lessens the availability. There's not that opening there. So we have gone, when he found that out, it was like, oh my gosh, here are the floodgates that can open up that we can actually go now work on healing all of the stuff that he had been going through. Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's never too late, too. You never know.
It's never too late.
Yeah.
Another incident, and this was probably 10-ish years ago, a family came out for a 4-day intensive with me from Chicago. A 13-year-old son who literally hated his mother. I mean, he said, I hate you. I mean, I've worked with a whole lot of people. I've never seen that level of sort of venom that was coming out. And I started going back, and they'd seen a bunch of other therapists, and they sort of came to me for this last resort. And this took like 2.5 days to figure out. We were going from like 8 a.m. till 5 or 6 at night. For some, and this doesn't happen very often, but he was allergic to his mother's breast milk. And she would breastfeed him, and it would make him sick. And then he was called failure to thrive. They would go back to the hospital. They went back there in his first 4 weeks of life. They were in the hospital 5 or 6 times I forget whether it was her or his dad, but sort of the mom and dad figured out together, maybe it's my breast milk that's making him sick. So his perspective was, mom, you're trying to kill me. That was his perspective. And not from any, I mean, that was precognitive, in many ways, precognitive, or at least prefrontal lobe. And clearly preverbal. But when we put that together, and I mean, his mother was sobbing, his father was sobbing, and he was sitting there going, oh my God, you weren't trying to kill me. And it was her, the doctors pushed her to continue to breastfeed. And when they changed to formula, he started to be healthy. Mm. But that, it was that early ingrained in my world, I call those interjects, somatic interject, mm-hmm. is that was there. And he literally lived his life thinking that his mother was trying to kill him. And he would say that. And when we started hitting that piece, it was like it took a while, but it was by the end of that 4 days was the first time he could actually look at his mom and say, "You had my best interest at heart."
Wow.
We had to do a bunch more work, but it was like it was a big deal. And interestingly enough, he just graduated from with a bachelor's degree. He did 5 years to do his bachelor's degree, and he's in psychology. So,
wow.
But it's like, it's those kinds of things that we need to look at. And if we don't know some of those stories, we don't know how to react. We don't know what to do. And let me, if it's okay, can I touch on one more thing?
Oh, yeah. I think this is all helpful. Yeah.
One of the biggest pieces that happens in all of this, and throughout our discussion here, I've talked a lot about contact. Mm-hmm. And so let me talk about what contact is to me.
Yeah.
And I used to joke when I taught that if you don't know the answer to a question that I ask, 87.5% of the time, the right answer is contact. I'd say that to my students. So contact is that place where we have an attuned presence with another person, and we're aware of where our spiritual, emotional, energetic, and physical boundaries touch another. So we're allowing our spiritual, energetic, physical, and emotional boundaries touch another's boundaries while we're in presence and attunement with that other person. And so if we're feeding our babies and we're not in contact, they're getting the food, but they're not getting the nurturing. Mm-hmm. Same way, like if, you know, I mean, what's clear, just how we're interacting, like I feel a tremendous amount of contact with you. It's there. And people, even later in life, people have sex without contact. People have babies without contact. People have, you know, they talk to each other and don't have contact. They have marriages and don't have contact. They parent their children without contact. So that's the other big piece that we really need to look at,
yeah.
is that whole piece of, can we build attachment through contact? Meaning, can we go through difficult times in contact, in relationship, and come out okay?
Yes, so important. Thank you for that. And I encourage a lot of people, clients, students, whatever, to really foster the relationship to self. And I'm curious, with your background and everything, you know, I'm hearing intimacy kind of threaded into the way you describe contact, of I'm thinking of deep connection, and I like in the yoga lens of the koshas, like we have these different layers mm-hmm. that mm-hmm. make us a whole being, and to tease apart each part, like, yes, we can physically be with somebody, but is our whole being there with them? And I think that's
right.
A reflection for the listeners too, to remember you have layers. You're not just a human with just one part of you, and it's not just your body, it's not just your mind. And so there's that. And then still is intimacy, I'll start there. Is intimacy the same as contact? Is there a different way to describe intimacy? Or I think of it as a deep connection, but is there something more to comparing them?
I think, yeah, that's a great question. So I think of intimacy as that deep sort of somatic spiritual connection that we can have with another being. And I don't think it's just between two people. Like I have horses. I do a lot of equine-assisted work. Or it can be with a tree that's outside. It can be with the Douglas pine, Douglas fir, that's outside my door. So let me walk through this piece real quickly. Contact is a really short, oftentimes a very short time period. Sometimes it's a few seconds, sometimes it's 10 seconds. But then we make contact, and then we might either, like you and I, like I'll make contact, and then as I'm thinking, I sort of look away, then I come back and make contact. So we're doing those pieces. When contact is predictable and consistent over time, that's the process that creates connection between two beings. When connection is predictable and consistent over time, that deepens and creates relationship. When relationship is consistent and predictable over time, that's what creates intimacy. But each of those steps are based on being able to have contact. Mm-hmm. So intimacy can actually be broken by going back and not having contact.
Yeah.
So again, the short way to say it is contact over time creates connection. Connection over time creates relationship. Relationship over time creates intimacy.
Mm. Yeah, and I like that.
And so, you know, I have friends that I've known like, you know, 50 or 60 years, and there's a deep level of intimacy. So in that, I'm not talking about sexual anything in that. I mean, my sister and I have an incredibly kind, intimate relationship. And because of that level of consistency and dependability. So.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you for that. And it trust comes in. I'm feeling trust in somewhere rippled into this too, and even trusting of self. And I like that you mentioned the trees and the horses, and I'd like to shift into, I don't know, we'll call it healing, repairing. I know you're a nature guy, a horse guy, and how do these external things help someone to heal some of these, whether it's people you know, contact, relational, attachment? How can you use nature or horses, and what have you learned in all the years you've done your work in that?
Right. That's a great question. So let me talk about that briefly. When we have been injured, like through lack of attachment or trauma or those kinds of things, oftentimes, and you have mentioned like trust in self, which I think is really important. We have to have a self so that we can be in contact. There are many times when people have gone through experiences where they don't trust other people. It's like, I'm not going to trust anybody. I'm not going to do this. I'm not going to do that. Actually, I just had lunch with a person that I met maybe a month ago, and we actually met in a dojo doing Aikido. And when you're working with each other and there's actually physical touch, and this person is a woman, and her first response was, "That's a little scary to me." And my response to her, because when you're teaching techniques, you're trying to help the other person learn. And I'm relatively advanced in that. She was fairly new. And I said, "Look, my job here is to help you." And she burst into tears. Mm-hmm. So trust is a big deal. Part of what was happening with her is it was actually through a little bit in a dojo that we did that. But then today, what I was talking to her about, and this is the underlying premise of all of this, is if somebody gets to a place where they are afraid or they don't trust another person, what I do is I go, okay, that's okay with me. Let me help you with horses, or let me help you with nature. So we can, part of what we can do, and this is actually was our conversation with this, that's why I brought her in, is it's like, if I can help somebody make contact with a horse, make connection, form relationship, and even intimacy with a horse, then that builds the foundation for them to learn how to do that and trust themselves. So they can take that as a stepping stone and a jump off place to go begin doing that with people. Same way, the exact same thing with nature, the exact same thing. So that's one piece. Does that make sense? So basically what we're doing is asking nature, asking horses, asking dogs to help us as a stepping stone to where we need to get to. So that's one piece. The other piece, and this is a piece with horses that this always blows me away, is a grown person coming into therapy needs the same thing as an infant does if there are major attachment issues. They need to be held and moved and rocked. Well, that's not going to go over so big in therapy. I have some 240-pound dude come in and I go, here, sit on my lap, let me rock you. It's not going to go over so big. But what I can do is put that person on the horse. And they can be held in a way that they've never been held before. And whether it's attachment stuff or even sexual trauma stuff, many times with touch, I can actually put a person on a horse and they can be touched the inside of the thighs and their genital area can be touched maybe for the first time in a safe way ever since whatever trauma they've experienced. Same way in nature, if I'm out in the woods or, you know, like literally touching a tree and making contact, there are many different kinds of ways that we can go with that. The other piece, and this is a piece that when I saw this the first time, I sort of blew my own mind, is, and when I say this, I always try to, I'm saying this with the utmost respect possible, that if you watch a woman who is pregnant walk from the back and you watch a horse walk, their pelvises move the exact same way. And I actually did videos of this. If somebody has had major, like one of the ways that we always get moved in utero is our mom's walking. One of the ways that I can do the very best of replicating that movement so people can move into that and feel it through their bodies is if I put somebody on a horse and walk them, they can get that exact as close as we can get, but it's pretty almost exact same movement. And what that does is it breaks loose all the somatic stuff that has been stuck inside somebody. And can, because they're being moved the way that either they didn't get to get moved in utero or that has been shut down since they've been born. And it's a little bit mind blowing. And if you look at it, our pelvises and a horse pelvis is exactly the same. If we take the pelvic bone structure out, it's virtually the same. You can't tell the difference except one's bigger than the other.
Wow. Yeah. And there's plenty of pelvis rabbit holes we could go down too. There's a lot loaded into the pelvis.
All the pelvis and perineum work and all of those kind of things. But what this does is it makes it super clean.
Yeah.
And it makes it super available.
Mm. Yeah.
Like I cannot tell you, even if I'm not doing that work, if I sit somebody on a horse, they go, this is the first time I've been able to relax forever. Those kinds of things. So
they're such amazing creatures. One of my somatic mentors does some therapy, equine therapy, and I did a session with her with some boundary work with horses and just really feeling, saying yes, saying no, and of course then somatically in the body. And yeah, I'd like to do more of it. It's really, really special if people have access to.
Well, the next time you're in Colorado,
I will be right there. we'll be right. I wanted to ride the horse too with her. It's like, oh, we're just doing boundary work today, and we just stayed on the ground. But you know, that was enough. But I was actually feeling that like little kid joy too to ride a horse. I think there's just so many different emotions that can be loosened and freed
in the
presence of a horse. Yeah, so neat. And I know we could talk forever about the horses as well. And you're making me think too, and around, I know there are people out there that, like you said, whether they don't trust people or maybe they call themselves introverts or maybe they just want to like hole up at home. And so this talk of having healthy relationships and attachments, they're sort of why do I need that? But life is relational if you're a human. And so you can relate to nature, you can relate to animals. You don't have to go and heal this through relating to humans. But then that's also making me question, and if spiritual bypassing comes up or disassociation. So when someone isn't wanting to step into some sort of relational repair, is that important? Like if you're a human being, should you look at your relationship to relationship? Or is that a form of bypassing if they're not wanting to look at it? Where do we draw the line of, yeah, just go be a hermit in a cave and not, you know, relate to anything in life? So I'm guessing there are people out there that are like, I don't care how I relate to people. I don't need to, you know, but then is that bypassing? Is that really missing out on what life is all about?
Well, I don't know that I would ever, I try not to do any shoulds. So what I will say is that we are designed to be in relationship. Period, end of story. And there are people, and usually what I would also say is, at least most of the time, the people in the world that go, yeah, I'll just go relate to nature and I'll just go relate to animals. There's been some sort of early relational injury there. What's interesting is the only way that we can repair relational injuries in relationship. What could happen if someone was willing to do it is to, like there are a lot of stepping stones in between going, I don't want to be with anyone, and all being in relationship. So for instance, a way to begin working with that is, I might have someone stand on one, someone who's saying that, on one side of a horse and groom, and I'll be on the other side. And the horse literally acts as essentially an energetic mediator. Another way is, and actually next August, I'm putting together a pack trip for, this particular one is for men, a horse pack trip to work with relationship. Well, the first relationship I'm going to work with is them and their horse. So people, even if somebody is saying, well, I'll go be with animals, I won't be with people though, they're still seeking out relationship. So what's one of the pieces that I bring in, and I think that I saw this on your website, is that we're all animal beings. And did I get that right?
Yes. Yeah. Some mention of that. Yeah.
Yeah. And so if we can come in and bring ourselves into going, yeah, well, I'm standing next to my horse and my horse is an animal being and I'm here. I just happen to have two legs to stand on instead of four, but I'm still an animal being. It's like, well, if I can help people relate to me, to the animal being part of me from their animal part of them, that's again the beginning. It's like, so what I work with is, what can you do? And what are you willing to give a shot to? And then we build on that. And in that, all of that, and what horses want, what another piece with horses that's interesting, at least to me, is that horses are prey animals. When we've experienced trauma or we've experienced lack of attachment, we become prey. So we're just like horses in that sense. So that's part of what helps us connect with horses, for instance. It's a different connection than we have with dogs, because dogs are predator animals. But horses protect themselves through relationship. That's their primary protection. And if we can help bring that to somebody, and there can be a shift of going, oh, I protect myself. And this is part of what you were talking about earlier, that awareness. If it's like, oh, well, relationships actually might protect me versus harm me, then we can begin moving through a lot of things that way.
Oh, I think that's a powerful statement there. Relationships might protect me. And for people out there who might have a belief that they don't even realize that they consciously have that, of that they enter a relationship with that belief that it's actually not a protected space, and to find a way to believe that they are.
Turn that on its head a little bit, because that can be really helpful.
And
and what all of us want in life is we want to know two things. Are we safe, and where do we belong? That's what we want to know.
Totally.
That's what horses want to know. That's what all beings want to know. And so there are places, even though we've had some really tough times with humans, we can find a place that's safe and we can belong.
Yeah. Oh, beautiful. Do you have a few more minutes?
Yeah.
Well, I do want to circle back to then the detachment, as we mentioned, or you mentioned just briefly with the Buddhism. And if anyone out there has heard me talk before, I probably mentioned surrendering and letting go, and, you know, believing that to be such a powerful practice. But from what you've seen, I think we've had similar but different backgrounds. Where does that fit in? Because there is a lot of talk around surrender, letting go being such a part of freedom, liberation, whatever you may say. But then here we are talking about healthy attachment. How do you get both healthy attachment and then the ability to pull back, detach?
That's a really fair question. Part of what people have asked me this a lot, and when, in my view, we're talking about actually two almost different things. One is a relational attachment to other beings. What's interesting is the healthier that relational attachment is to other beings, the easier it is to let go of judgment, let go of projection, let go of needing things to be in a certain way, which is the way that I look at that other kind of detachment. And actually, at Naropa, which is a Buddhist study center, it's like that's actually what is spoken about there. And even if we speak, I was fortunate enough. How long ago was this? Probably 25 years ago, to have a private audience with the Dalai Lama. And that's actually what he said. Well, the Dalai Lama said, it's not that you don't have relationships. It's that you don't judge relationships. It's not that you don't do things in life. It's that you don't judge what you do in life. It's not that you don't work towards something. It's that you don't judge whether or not you get there. That it's truly that process of being in the present and knowing that you're in the present and living from that place without judgment.
Feels free to me. Freer.
Well, the piece that I've said to people is that the better that we've had, that we have our early attachment, or that we've healed whatever wounds happened there, the easier it is to move into a non-attached place and just let life be and let ourselves be.
Yes. And I think you said maybe before we hit record here of then the bypassing too, where it can be a slippery slope of spiritual bypassing versus like a detaching, having a healthy, safe anchor.
Right. Yeah. And that's what attachment is having like a healthy, safe anchor. And then we go, okay, well, right now I'm just going to be.
Yeah.
So oftentimes I'll say this, and I say this with care, because I don't want anyone listening to this and going, oh, well, this guy's judging me. When we have really struggled with early attachment, we do have more of a tendency to, in the detached process, that looking at letting go, and that we have more of a tendency to do a bit of a spiritual bypassing in that. And the way that I see that happening is that the spiritual bypassing is that process of not being grounded in that letting go of that detached place. Mm-hmm. If you've even seen the Dalai Lama or heard videos, he is like grounded. He is like boom. And he's not floating around any place. And at least on that energetic level. And so he's, when he speaks about detached or letting go of things, it's like, that's from a very grounded place.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. I observe the spiritual bypassing the same, and feeling that there's something that's just a little cut off, not connected. And that's
right.
Potentially creating this urge to just float over things versus being able to, because it's a relationship to even the things that people might bypass. There's a relationship to explore there to, ultimately it's because they want the thing to be better or disappear, but instead of going into it, they bypass over it. Yeah.
Yeah. The way into it, the way through it. What is that? Mm-hmm.
The only way out is through. Yeah. Yeah, right, yeah. Versus so, above and over. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And all of that comes back to me, comes back to what I call contact. The people that I've seen and in my life when I've been able to experience that letting go is when I'm in the most contact with myself and with others.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I really I'm grateful for now having that in my vocabulary and understanding it in that way. I think that's a really profound concept that I will now be sharing
with
people. Yes, thank you. So, the building blocks of that really makes a lot of sense in my mind and in my body. I feel like a lot of truth in that. So
yeah. So it's like that's what we want. In the same way, I mean, even when I ride, because I ride a lot, what I'm working on essentially is not like I've ridden so much, and frankly, I've had so many riding lessons in my life. But it's like, I'm not worried. I don't worry about technique. That's not what happens. What I worry about is being truly in contact with my horse and letting my energetic center and his energetic center connect. And then we can pretty much do anything. All the rest just comes. But that's a deep attachment at the same time of having, it's like, we're good. I don't need to be worrying, which is the detachment stuff.
Yeah. Oh, that's a great example. And as you said, I was like, that sounds like the best relationship ever. You know, to be able to have that energetic alignment and to feel worry-free at the same time. And that's
exactly
feels like that's what it's all about.
Lovely when that happens.
Yeah. Well, we'll kind of loop this to an end here, but I will bring in, you know, mindfulness. The word can mean a lot of things. I like to just, it's awareness, having awareness around any of the things that we've just spent time talking about and so much more. But you've had tens of thousands of hours with people in our modern life and civilization and culture. Why is having awareness in your own definition, why is that important right now more than ever in terms of the state of the world, what you're seeing in people you work with? Why is awareness something to cultivate?
The awareness or the mindfulness piece?
Yeah.
Mindfulness to me includes the awareness that you're talking about. It also includes like knowing energetically who we are and being able to, on an energetic, and when I say energetic level, I'm including spiritual in that those are the words I use, is on an energetic level, being aware of who we are And there's a piece coming here where it's like knowing who we are and where we're at, and in sort of our quote animal body, knowing where we are and where we fit is actually more important than who we are. And being in that place of going, okay, I can expand and allow myself to fit here. In that awareness, and allow what needs to come in, and allow what needs to go out. And that's sort of how I would look the best I can do at sort of explaining sort of that mindfulness piece.
Yeah.
Which has to do with coming from our heart and our soul versus coming from our brains or even our bodies sometimes. But
yeah.
I think a lot of that comes through our bodies.
Yeah. Yeah. I love it. Thank you. Yeah. Have not had that answer before. So noted.
Oh, that's cool.
Noted. Yeah. Yeah. It's good. Unique. Yes. Well, Dewey, I know you've got some things coming up. You mentioned next summer. Are there other projects you have, experiences, offerings that you'd like to share about here? And I'll always put it in the show notes, but just to put some voice
great.
To it.
Yeah, I'm doing a bunch of different things. One is I'm continuing to put together, I'm actually sort of in the process of weaning off of seeing clients individually. Although Kimberly, my partner, is also a therapist, so we do some couples intensives. We also teach nature-based classes. We teach a lot of the horse nature. It's actually nature, land, and equine classes, working with that. I'm also putting together, I've been doing a lot of men's work. One of the things I'm finding is that if I can really affect a lot of the attachment stuff with men, things go a lot better for a lot of people. And so I'm very dedicated to that. In March, I think it's March, it's the end of February, 1st of March, I'm doing a 3-day class on working with men, how to work with men. Part of what I see is in universities, about 80% of people in learning to be therapists are women, and about 80% of the teachers are women. And so it's skewed toward women. And what I will say is, I don't think that's purposeful. I don't think no one's getting up in the morning and going, oh, I want to do this. If it were 80% men, and either way, it'd be the same thing skewed that way. But it's like, I do think there is some uniqueness in how we can work with men. And particularly from an attachment place. I'm in the process of putting together like a relationship class. The other big thing that I'm doing, and this is sort of one of the most fun things I do, and this is for people who have been coaches and or therapists for a period of time who are pretty skilled. It's actually called The Art of Instinct and Intuition in Therapy and Coaching. And that's a 6-month intensive class that Kimberly and I run. We did our first one last year. I think it went really, really well, and we learned a whole lot from it. So we're putting that together. That starts in April.
That sounds awesome.
Yeah, it's so much fun because we get really skilled, high-level people coming in that really are going, I wanted the next step and I haven't been able to find it anyway. And that's what we're trying to provide. Those are the big things. Places to find that. Can I?
Yeah.
Like, there's a website, the Gestalt Equine Institute site, that people can find. That's the Gestalt Equine Institute of the Rockies. Kimberly runs the Colorado Ecotherapy Institute, and all of my stuff's under DeweyFreeman.org.
It's yeah.
Pretty easy to find.
Great. Yeah. I'll put all that below, and such great work. And a shout out to Traver for connecting us. I was chatting with him and just sharing my my pull for a lot of this year specifically to highlight more support for men and feeling the call as well and knowing that whatever I can help to share that. So I'm really grateful to have that connection and to meet you here and know that you're offering that to the world. And, you know, I think it is a very needed and impactful avenue of healing specifically for the men's work. And then of course, everything else you're sharing, just this, I don't know if I say high level, but you've been at this for so long. So I just really value.
Well, actually, we need women who really like working with men. Okay. I think women working with men can be really incredibly powerful and really incredibly healing. I mean, as well as men working with men.
Right.
I'm not poo-pooing that. I just think that don't count yourself out of that. There's a lot of really, really powerful good stuff that can happen.
Thank you.
So
yeah. Appreciate that.
Yeah.
And I really value what you just shared.
One of the most powerful things that can happen and that does happen is Kimberly and I work together. Mm-hmm. And I mean, Traver is a very good friend of mine. And part of his feedback, because he's seen us work together, he goes, Dewey, you sort of come in and you drop these big concepts and it's sort of like, here comes the bomb, and it sort of goes, and everyone goes, oh my goodness. And then Kimberly sort of comes in and allows it to be more fluid and people go, oh, okay, I can handle that. So
yeah,
we need everybody.
Yeah.
And so, and I actually, in working with women at too, I mean, we need men who can work with women because that helps us heal. That helps us heal. And that's part of what we really need. So going,
I agree,
in all directions.
Yeah. Yeah. Like that. We need everyone. Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you for all of this, Dewey. Thank you. And it's just such a pleasure. And I'm so glad that we're acquainted now. And
Yeah, this is great. I'd love to stay in touch.
Thank you. We will. And listeners, you know where to find him. Check the show notes. Follow up, follow along. And thanks for listening. And we'll see you all next time. Goodbye. Bye, Dewey.
All right. Thank you very much.
Yes. Thank you. You're welcome.